live. And if you believe that, boy, have I got some prime real estate for you, but be sure to wear your hip boots. It's the Mike Novak Show. Many have tried to emulate it, some have tried to forget it, but like the fruit fly in the middle of your glass of Merlot, you can't ignore it. Time to sing.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, everybody, for tuning in, however you're listening. The Green Divas Global Digital Network at GDGDRadio.com, or iTunes, or Spreaker, or Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or the GLN Radio Network. And, of course, at MikeNovak.net, MikeNovak.net. You can follow my exploits at The Mike Novak Show on Facebook. And on Twitter, you can find me with the handle at Mike Now. Drop me a line anytime you like, Mike@MikeNovak.net. If you're a gardener, and even if you're not, you might have seen a graphic that has been making the rounds of the ether tubes. It has the headline, Weed Be Gone. But we're not talking about the ortho product that you find on store shelves. In fact, it kind of makes me wonder why whoever put that thing together would use that headline, because this Weed Be Gone product is kind of the opposite of the ortho product. It's something you can mix up on your kitchen counter with stuff you can find in your own home. Here are the ingredients. 1 gallon vinegar, 2 cups Epsom salt, and I must note that the word used is Epson, E-P-S-O-N, as in the people who make the printers, not Epsom, E-P-S-O-M, as would be the correct spelling. But I digress. The final ingredient is 1/4 cup Dawn dish soap, Blue Original. The rest of the graphic reads, quote, "It will kill anything on which it is sprayed. Just mix and spray in the morning after the dew has evaporated. Check back after dinner and the weeds are gone!" Exclamation mark. Cheaper than anything else. And never, capitalized never, buy Roundup again! Double exclamation mark. For any reason! Double exclamation mark. Heck, I'm sold. Except, is it true? Well, as I was looking up some stuff on the Stupernet, I came across a video by a guy named Dave Marciniak. He's a landscaper in Culpeper, Virginia, who decided to put that homegrown recipe to the test. And by the way, you can go to my website, MikeNovak.net, and you'll see the graphic I'm talking about. And it, like I said, it's been everywhere on the internet for the last couple of years, so you'll probably recognize it. Anyway, I spent a couple of segments in today's show talking to him about the difference between using vinegar and glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, on your weeds. And let me add just one comment about weed killers, since I failed to mention it when I was talking to Dave. I'll say it here. The problem with pesticides, whether store-bought or blended in your basement, is that too many people don't read and follow label directions. And their motto is, if some is good, more is better. Folks are like that about fertilizer and watering too, and that makes me crazy. My feeling is that if you don't know how, or you're not going to bother to read label directions, do us all a favor and don't use anything at all. Or pave over your yard, whatever. Just don't make me come over there and whoop you upside the head with a rolled up newspaper, because I will. Anyway, the final segment today is with my buddy, meteorologist and climate educator, Rick DeMaio, who takes a look at the building El Nino in the Pacific Ocean and speculates on what that means for the current hurricane season, as well as the winter in North America and worldwide. We have a little reference to the Farmer's Almanac in that segment. And he sent me some interesting links and graphics, which you can find on my website, MikeNovak.net. I'm glad you decided to join me today. The Mike Novak Show starts right after this.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf.
Mr. Data, be more specific.
Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Of course. Attack of the Killer Asparagus is required reading at Starfleet Academy.
Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Gwynock of Ninglador.
Captain, shields are failing.
Thank you, Mr. Worf. Mr. Data, options.
Captain, it seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
Aroundtheblockpress.com. What do they have to say?
It appears that Mike Novak is a slapstick every gardener, taking all our self-delusions, mishaps, and confusions and playing them for big laughs.
That's not very helpful, Mr. Data.
No, it is, however, highly accurate.
If you're a friend of the Earth, you're a friend of mine. One of the tools I recommend for great growing results in your yard is Milorganite Organic Nitrogen Fertilizer. Milorganite's slow-release, goof-proof formula provides consistent feeding, and it's safe for your children and pets. Milorganite contains 85% organic matter, which promotes beneficial microbial activity and improves the soil's ability to grow and nurture grass and plants. Milorganite, for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com for a store near you.
I take two. Okay.
It's the Mike Novak Show. Great to have you with me. The other day, I was cruising the intertubes for a very specific reason, actually. I was doing some research on glyphosate. Now, you might know that, or maybe you don't know, that glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup, which is an herbicide. Some people find it controversial, and other people use it all the time. And I was doing my research because I was going to go down to the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District to do some testimony. And this is something I'm going to talk about on the show soon, because one of the commissioners there, Frank Avila, is working to get the district to stop using synthetic chemicals, specifically glyphosate. Now, we can discuss the merits of that back and forth, but it was an interesting day, and I hope to get him and maybe another commissioner on the show soon to talk about that. But while I was looking up some stuff, I ran across a video by a guy named Dave Marciniak, and he's a landscape designer in Virginia. And it had to do with Roundup, and it had to do with vinegar. And if you're a gardener, and even if you're not, you might have seen this thing floating across the inner tubes about using vinegar and a little bit of detergent and Epsom salts. Except in that thing, they've got it spelled Epson, as in the printer, the company that makes the printer. And that doesn't give me a lot of confidence when I see something like that. So I saw this video, and I was intrigued by it. And so I thought, you know what? I got to contact Dave Marciniak and bring him on the program. So that's exactly what I did. And live via Skype, we have Dave Marciniak. Dave, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Mike. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And it's funny because on your video, that you put together about your test. And by the way, I should let people know if they're looking for it online, and I will post this on my website, so I'll have the direct link to the video. So we'll see if we can give you a little bump there. I don't know how big a bump that's actually going to be. But Dave calls it Roundup versus Vinegar Weed Killer, the ultimate test. And I noticed that you even put the picture of the thing that's floating around Facebook, which is the Weed Be Gone solution with vinegar, Epsom salts with an N. I know. And every time I see that, I cringe. And 1/4 cup Dawn dish soap. And folks are saying, hey, you can use this. It's just as good as Roundup. It's going to take care of your weeds. You're not going to have any more problems. Dave Marciniak, what's wrong with that?
Well, so when the first time I saw it coming around was probably about a year and a half ago. And I just saw that recipe going around, and it just, you know, it just didn't pass the sniff test for me as a weed killer that was going to be a one-to-one substitution for Roundup, because we know what Roundup does, and vinegar can be used as weed killer, and I understand some of the thinking behind it, but it just seemed really kind of, you know, vague promises that didn't really add up. And then all of a sudden, in the last couple months, I noticed it making a resurgence and people saying it works just as well as or better than Roundup. And all of a sudden I went, okay, now we've got something that I can do an actual comparison of, because we all know what Roundup or glyphosate does. You spray it, you walk away. A week later, everything's dead. 2 weeks later, everything's still dead. 3 weeks later, everything's still dead, except for, you know, really pervasive, deep-rooted stuff and some of that. So I thought, okay, if this will actually do this, that is awesome, but I just don't buy it, because I looked at the components, the Epsom salts, I couldn't quite figure out what they were going for there. The vinegar, I've heard it used as a weed killer. I had never actually tried it myself before I did this test, but I've heard that it works. And they were even saying to use this in a household concentration, which is the 5% acetic acid. So I thought, okay, that's really ambitious to say that that's going to be equivalent to or better than Roundup. And then the dish soap, I mean, it's a surfactant. It's what, when I was doing commercial applications, we would mix a surfactant in with what we were spraying, because again, it helps it stick to the leaf surfaces a little bit better.
Can I stop you right there, Dave? Say when you were doing commercial applications, so you have a history of this. Are you licensed, a pesticide licensed guy?
No, right now. So all I've done for the last 10 years has just been strictly landscape design. So I don't I don't get involved in the application side or anything like that. But I actually used to, in my early 20s, I used to maintain, I was head groundskeeper for a research facility in California, and so that was one of the jobs that we did was, you know, weed suppression and going through and fertilization and all that. So it's something that I'm familiar with, and I kind of understand some of the thoughts behind it.
Sure.
And so when I was trying to come up with an idea for a comparison, I decided to search and see what was out there. See, you know, because obviously if somebody has already done a head-to-head comparison, there's no sense reinventing the wheel. I can just share that with people that are interested. And there really wasn't. The only ones that I really found where people said, okay, let's test this versus this, it was really kind of random. It was sort of like, okay, well, I've got a patch of weeds over here, I'll spray them with this, and there's a random little patch of weeds over here, spray them with that. And to me, it just didn't seem like... Obviously, mine is not. Nobody would ever say mine was academically rigorous, but it's...
Right. But as you're saying, and that's okay too, really. But at least what you were doing is you had some kind of control. You were doing it in a methodical way. You're not going to have a peer-reviewed paper come out at the University of Virginia, okay? I understand what you were doing and why you were doing it. And, well, why don't you explain what you did? Because I have some questions about what happened there. So let's proceed with your science experiment, Dave's great science experiment.
Well, so what I did is I decided to dedicate my front yard to the cause. We took down a big sweet gum tree in the front yard last year or 2 years ago. I don't remember at this point. And all of a sudden, as will happen when a yard that was once full shade goes to full sun, the weeds just exploded. Everything that had been sitting there latent said, okay, this is awesome. We're taking over. So my front yard... My front yard is mowed, but it's not pretty. It's a weedy mess.
Hey,
so
Dave, I got to stop you there. You're a landscape designer. Come on, pal. What's the story?
Cobbler's kids have no shoes. It's what I fall back on. You know, it's the nice thing is we did a really nice project for a winery that's about 10 minutes down the road. So any new neighbors that I meet that go, "You're a landscape designer, really?" I just say, "You know what? Just go to the winery. You can see what I do there. Just don't look at my house." It is what it is.
No, that's fine. I totally get you. I've been there, done that.
Yeah, we're slowly getting there. But yeah, so what I did is I decided to divide my yard into 2-foot by 2-foot squares with a 2-foot buffer in between each square so I didn't have to worry about overspray or contamination or anything else. And so what I tested is I tested actually a commercial formulation of Roundup, like what you buy in the spray bottle. If you just say, you know what, I want Roundup, I don't want to have to mix it, I don't have to do anything, I just want to pick up a weed killer and squirt something with it and be done. Because I figured that's something that a lot of people are going to just pick up off the shelf and use. I then used a real basic Roundup concentrate mixed according to the bottle directions. So it's, you know, glyphosate, and there's probably a couple other ingredients in there as well. I'd have to look at the label again. And then what I did is I started breaking down the vinegar components just because I was really kind of curious to see what would happen because, again, I had no experience with the vinegar stuff. So I did straight vinegar. I did vinegar with dish soap mixed in as a surfactant. And then I did this Weed Be Gone thing with the vinegar, the Epsom salts, and the dish soap. And then just out of curiosity, just because I didn't see the reason to have Epsom salts in there, but I thought, okay, let's see what Epsom salts do on their own. So I also did a formulation of Epsom salts dissolved just in water. So each one of those squares got sprayed, and then I just walked away and checked in on them every couple days. And it was actually kind of funny because I took some composite lumber and just Sharpied on what was sprayed in each square. And again, this is right up against the sidewalk. I live in a downtown area for a small town in rural Virginia. And in running into my neighbors, it was just funny because they're all like, "Oh, this is so great. We're so glad you did this. And we're really glad that you labeled them, Dave, because we were able to watch as this went on and see what was going on." So apparently I provided free entertainment for my neighbors, which was pretty awesome, too.
Which is a good thing. And your results showed?
So my results, I got to admit, I was surprised because having never tried vinegar as a weed killer, I wasn't expecting much. I was expecting maybe seeing like a little bit of like brown stippling on the leaves or something. But for the most part, I was expecting the weeds to kind of go, "Hey, awesome, you sprayed us with salad dressing, thanks." But I mean, holy cow, it really burned the heck out of the leaves with the vinegar right off the bat. Also right off the bat, the Roundup in the spray bottle, the premix, clearly has some other stuff in there to make you feel like you've accomplished something, because those results were almost instantaneous as well. The actually mixed glyphosate from concentrate in the bottle, that took probably 3 or 4 days to really kind of get cooking and start knocking the weeds back. But what I found at the end of about a week and a half, where I had sprayed with vinegar was already starting to make a comeback. And then at the 3-week mark, everything was totally greened up again where I had sprayed any of the vinegar solutions, and the Roundup was still dead. So to me, it kind of clearly demonstrated that, you know, look, if you want to say that it's an option for weed killer, absolutely, 100% on board with it. Go for it, especially if you don't like using chemicals like, you know, Roundup or glyphosate or whatever. But I think that kind of demonstrated that if you have something that you want dead and that needs to stay dead, it's kind of hard to top glyphosate. And obviously there's a ton of worry and concern, and there's emotional issues and everything else tied up with glyphosate.
Well, we'll get into that in a second here, because you're right. There's a lot of emotional issues associated with Roundup and its parent company, Monsanto. You know, and Monsanto doesn't own the patent to Roundup anymore, to glyphosate. They still make Roundup because that's really, really popular. But glyphosate went into the public domain in 2000, so like 15 years ago. So there are other products out there that have glyphosate in them, but Roundup is probably the most popular. And as you know, glyphosate is probably the most widely used weed killer herbicide in the world. Which is a good reason to do a test like this. You're very funny when you say, when you come back and you say something's still dead. Well, dead is dead. Dead is dead. So I knew this was going to happen. I knew we were going to go over our time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a short break right here, Dave Marciniak. And when we come back, then I have all my questions for you. And we'll see where this goes. That's Dave Marciniak. He is a landscape designer out of Virginia with Revolutionary Gardens. You can find it at revolutionarygardens.com. And don't forget that you can get more information about this at mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net. We will continue our conversation about vinegar versus glyphosate right after this.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakening Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com or call us today at 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the bombs.
It's time for my questions. It's the Mike Novak Show. I'm glad you're listening. Thank you so much. I'm with Dave Marciniak. What town in Virginia did you say you're at, Dave?
So I live in Culpeper, Virginia. It's a small little town about halfway between D.C. and Charlottesville.
Ah, okay. In Culpeper, Virginia. And Dave runs an outfit called RevolutionaryGardens.com. Why do you call it Revolutionary Gardens?
You know, there's a couple things. I mean, obviously, Virginia has some significant ties to the Revolutionary War. But it's also, I really kind of encourage people to think outside the box, sort of explore different ideas and really kind of make their landscapes theirs in a way that their neighbors are not doing. So it's sort of a nice little double meaning there.
All right. And we were talking in the first segment about your test you did to compare, because as we've said before, if you're on Facebook, especially, you see this thing that goes around and it says, hey, you can use vinegar just as easily as, just as effectively as Roundup to kill weeds. And you did a test, a more or less scientific test with real methodology and that sort of thing, and found out that, well, maybe that's not the case. Well, first question I have for you is about the vinegar, because one of the things you do not mention in your test is what kind of vinegar did you use? Because I'm sure you're aware that there is a thing called horticultural vinegar. Did you use kitchen vinegar?
I did. And so what I did is I looked at, I did an internet search and I tried to sort of get a cross section of these recipes. And I actually only found a very, very small handful of them that called for horticultural strength vinegar. The majority of them were saying, you know, totally just use Heinz white vinegar, what you would use for making hot pickled carrots or cleaning your windows or whatever it is that you're going to do.
Yeah.
And so that's why I opted to do that. I mean, it's the nice thing about living in an agricultural area like I do is I can get my hands on any of that stuff pretty easily. But the majority of what I was seeing out there was calling for, again, the idea behind these recipes and home brews and everything else is to find things that you can walk into any grocery store, any hardware store, put this together, and an hour later be good to go. So,
you know, that's kind of the Jerry Baker mentality there. Isn't,
exactly.
You know, America's master gardener. And I always found, and I've said this before on my program, I found his solutions much more complex and daunting than just going to the store and getting the right product.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, my dad was a huge fan of his. And, yeah, it's the amount of cheap beer we sprayed on our backyard was pretty insane.
Old Milwaukee, Goebbels. What was the beer you guys used?
My dad, believe it or not, was a Schlitz drinker.
So Schlitz. So. Stroh's in Detroit. We drank a lot of Stroh's beer there. America's only fire brewed beer. But so the point, the reason I ask, and I understand why you did that, is you, because this was a recipe that had people go into their kitchen tables, all right, and finding what they could in their cupboard to kill weeds. But, and I've been saying this for 20 years when I go to garden clubs and speak about this, if you really want to have a chance of killing those weeds, you should get horticultural strength vinegar, because that's 20%. Vinegar, whereas the vinegar that you use in cooking and that is in your kitchen is only 5% strength. And I would think, what I would have done is add one more patch, which is with the horticultural strength vinegar, put another square in there for your science experiment, just to see what the difference with that was, because there are people out there who don't want to use Roundup. For a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. So if the vinegar out of your kitchen isn't going to be strong enough, maybe there is a product that doesn't do the same thing that Roundup does, and it allows you to not go down that road. And it is sold at garden centers and online, and it's not that hard to get horticultural strength vinegar. So I kind of wonder what would have happened if had you used that.
Well, and it is something that I've, you know, I kind of always had in the back of my head as if we're going to do a follow-up, that's something I'm definitely interested in okay. doing. But, you know, because honestly, like I said, I did not expect 5% vinegar to do what it did. It was more of a result than I was honestly expecting. And so.
Yeah, but it didn't do anything. It just killed back the leaves, but not the roots. And obviously the plants came back.
Well, that's more than I was expecting. But so what I, you know, and again, so one thing that I, you know, had occurred to me to possibly test is, you know, perhaps, you know, in the cracks of a concrete parking lot or something where it's a much more inhospitable environment, you know, a couple applications of vinegar to weeds there, is that going to damage and stress the plant enough that it's effective there? I mean, there's so many different variables. It's really hard to kind of control for all of them. So I was trying to. With this being sort of a, you know, home scientist sort of thing, I was trying to minimize the number of variables I was playing with and still try to come up with a good result. So I'm
well, and the other thing that I've always told people when I talk to them about these issues is, yeah, if you use vinegar, you're probably going to have to go back and do it again. And it makes mm-hmm. me wonder what would have happened had you hit those weeds a second time with vinegar and maybe a third time. And by that time, it's possible that the plants would have given up the ghost, that said, okay, enough, stop, I give. As you said, there's a lot of variables here, and that would be a test for another experiment, is what happens if you go back a week later and hit it with vinegar again?
Well, exactly, because, again, the premise that I was testing in this was, is vinegar as good or better than Roundup in terms of its performance? And so that's literally all I was testing. I mean, I definitely think that based on what I saw and the way that it burns the foliage, I think there's some potential there. But I think that, at least for me, having come from a commercial background, to me, if you're going to say that they're equivalent, I think to me that also means, you know, speed and efficacy.
Yeah, well, but you know, and that gets to the heart of the matter, which is, and it's one of the things I said at the testimony at the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District the other day, which is, we're addicted to quick and easy, and we're addicted to Roundup because it's that whole thing where you got a dandelion in the crack of your sidewalk and you see the commercials on television and the guy's, you know, shooting it like he's a gunslinger. And I said, if you believe that stuff, if you go in for that stuff, you've been brainwashed. You've been brainwashed to think that every time you got a dandelion in the crack of your sidewalk, you need to go out there and be a gunslinger, and that's just crazy, all right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two things at play. And I mean, one is obviously culturally we're conditioned to, there's a problem, there's an easy solution. Let's take a pill for it, whatever. Yeah, so, but, you know, the other thing is just, you know, expectations and setting expectations and what we expect our landscapes to look like. And that's one of the conversations that I have with my homeowners, that, you know, if you want a yard that looks like AstroTurf, that's doable. It's not really anything I'm interested in, but you can certainly do that. And the same thing, I think there's being obsessive, and then I think there's a way of finding to coexist with nature, because at the end, nature's going to win. It doesn't matter what you do. I mean, we all saw Jurassic Park.
I know what it's about. I get the idea. But I'm with you there completely. And obviously, you're the guy who proves that with your own front lawn. You know, my deal is mow it, and it's green, and there you go. Hey, what's the problem? I've been in garden talks where I bring up ground ivy or creeping Charlie, whatever you call it, and people hiss. and I look at them and I say, folks, it's not a moral judgment. It's a plant. It's just a plant that's trying to grow someplace. And you're not a bad neighbor if you're not a gunslinger out there with your Roundup. And I'm with you. It's just, we got to get over that. We've just got to get past that. That's just the idea of the perfect lawn. Stop that. You're just being obsessive, as you said. It leads me to that question you had brought up, and I'm glad you did, because you did this little soapbox thing on your video about Roundup. And there's a lot of people who don't want to use this stuff. And I'm 100% with them. It's like, it's tied into Monsanto, and they're the evil empire, of course. and it's tied into GMOs. And for some people, that's really evil. There's a lot of emotion behind all these kinds of decisions. And the point you're making is, if you make this decision, make sure you know what you're doing and don't kid yourself about a product that might not work. Now, we don't know, you and I, because you haven't gone back and you didn't spot treat again with vinegar to see if, you know, the second or third time it might work. And then we can tell people, you know, if you like vinegar, you got to apply it more than once. If you want to use Roundup, you're only going to have to do it once. However, if you hate glyphosate, well, then either you're going to use vinegar more than once, or you're going to start digging. And it's kind of, those are the options, aren't they, Dave?
Well, yeah. And, you know, sort of like I mentioned in my video, as far as I'm concerned, unless you've got something that is just so pernicious and so rooted in that it's not an option, mechanical removal is going to be the best way. I mean, just pull that sucker out and stay on top of it. Then you don't have to worry about overspray. You don't have to worry about what you're introducing into the environment. I mean, you know, it's funny. I had, in 2012, I came down with Lyme disease. And
yikes.
It totally knocked me back. And, you know, I'm really lucky I didn't get cited for sort of how my yard got overgrown and everything else, because I didn't even have the energy to get out there and cut my grass or maintain my beds or anything else. And, you know, what am I going to do? Round up everything and just say goodbye to my hostas and, you know, everything else that I've got out there? So instead, I actually found somebody, hired them to come in and clean everything up. And, you know, she actually sat there for 8 hours hand weeding everything. Looked pristine. I didn't lose any of my plants. If you really are opposed to the idea of a chemical control, you're not going to beat mechanical removal. Sort of to the point that you made earlier, I'm really kind of curious to test vinegar a little bit more and see, you know, different concentrations or repeated applications, what that does. But, you know, I've been around this industry long enough that I just kind of feel like nothing beats mechanical removal, which, you know, for most people is hand removal.
That's it. That's the answer. And the other thing you can do is you can make your turf outcompete the weeds. That's mm-hmm. one of the ways to do that. And you do that, you can do it organically. You can add compost, you can overseed, you can core aerate, you know, do all the conditions to make your lawn stronger. And the stronger and healthier your lawn is, the fewer weeds you're going to have.
No, absolutely. The guy we bought the house from was a very old school, you know, probably 7 applications of various stuff on the lawn a year. And, you know, of course, we moved Yikes. In, we didn't do that. But it's amazing. So I had 1 year where there was a little bit of a resurgence of the weeds, you know, cranked my mower up to the highest setting, and it just, with not having the grass as stressed, with having longer grass, and a little bit of spot treatment by hand, you know, just pulling stuff that's particularly nasty. I mean, I've got a pretty decent backyard. I mean, I oversee with clover, which is fine, but...
Oh my God, clover's a weed. What are you doing?
Yeah, what? You know what? I'll take my magic fixing of atmospheric nitrogen. Thank you very much.
I know. Isn't that amazing? People say to me, well, how do I get rid of clover? And I'm like, what do you mean? Why are you trying to get rid of clover? It's putting nitrogen in your ground for free.
Yeah, I've found that when I speak to groups, when that question comes up, that actually generates a pretty lively conversation.
Dave Marciniak, I want to give you a chance to, like a minute plug for your outfit, Revolutionary Gardens.
All right, awesome. I appreciate it. Well, what I would love is for people to go to revolutionarygardens.com, read through my blog, kind of learn a little bit more about what we do. Honestly, that's a big part of what I'm enjoying now is I love doing landscape design for folks, but the other thing that I really enjoy is just talking about the design process, talking about plants, talking about gardening, and really what the path is that you can take to creating an awesome space. Obviously, I would love for people to hire me, but at the end... But
have to live in Virginia. That's one of the things.
Well, I actually do online design.
Oh, do you really? That's great.
I do. Yeah, I've lived all over the country, so I'm pretty familiar with a lot of different climate zones and requirements and everything else. So it's it works out well, but it's, you know, my bigger thing right now is just I'm really trying to focus on providing the best content that I can for people that are interested in actually learning more about the design process. I sort of, when we talk about what we tend to do as a culture and take the easy solution and everything else, what I find is there's a lot of fatigue with some of what's out there for garden information right now, which is just a lot of, you know, makeover stuff, quick fix, everything else. And I've spoken to groups where I've actually talked about design principles and how you can use resources around you, how you can find great resources like your county extension agent and different websites and independent garden centers, and really just kind of almost create your own advisory board to do something awesome with your space. And
yeah.
That's what I would love for people to go to my site and learn a little bit about, because that's what we're trying to put out there on a weekly basis.
Well, they then should go to revolutionarygardens.com. You're right about one thing. Everybody wants the makeover, and don't even get me started on HGTV and their makeover shows, okay? Dave Marciniak, it's been a pleasure talking to you. When you do your next round of testing, you're obviously going to contact me so we can talk about it on my show.
Absolutely, will do.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A+ by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Every time I open up an issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, I know I'm going to learn something. And if you've ever read my column on the inside back page of said magazine, you'd understand what a compliment that is, because I don't learn anything easily. You might pick up some knowledge in one of the excellent feature articles or one of the regular departments like Ask the Garden Pros, or the regional reports, or What to Do in the Garden, or... you might even be inspired by one of the luscious photos. Not only that, but Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is just one of 21 different publications of state-by-state gardening. Wherever you live in the Midwest or the South, State-by-State Gardening has a magazine for you. They feature articles by some of the leading gardening experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners, and even me. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600. Thanks for listening to the Mike Novak Show, what I call the collision of forces that shape the environment in our backyards and on our planet. Well, it's been a while since I've had one of my favorite people in the environmental world, Rick DeMaio. I should say meteorologist Rick DeMaio on the program, so it's time to welcome him back. How you doing, Rick?
Doing great, Mike. It's been a nice warm start to our climatological fall.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's exactly how we want things to go, but
We got to explain that, you know, it warm start here in the Midwest. I heard the other day that there was some snow in the mountains of Montana, so it kind of depends on where you are.
Yeah, and in fact, even when I was out west for 2 weeks, it was, I believe, the 25th of July. I was at the base of the Grand Tetons at about 6,500 feet, and a strong cold front came through. And sure enough, the mountains were dusted with about 3 or 4 inches of snow, and the snow level came down to almost 9,000 feet, which is really unheard of for late July. And even talking to a couple of people out there, they said that's kind of unusual. But yet, parts of that area had one of their driest and warmest winters on record. A couple people actually said the golf course has opened up late April. They never seen that before. So
wow.
It seems that we just see more and more of these type of highly variable weather patterns.
Yeah, in fact, we that's what one of the things we'll talk about here. But before we do, because I know that people in other parts of the country hear my podcasts, and folks in Chicago know Rick DeMaio, and you know, it's funny, I'll run into people in and around the Chicago area, and they ask me how you're doing, and they love hearing you on the show. But for folks who are in other parts of the country, give me a little bit about who you are and what you've done over the years. Obviously, you're a meteorologist.
I'm out on parole, which is good. No, I'm kidding. Which is why I'm on the radio.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually going to mark 30 years here in Chicago on the 1st of December.
Really?
And when I left New York to come out here to get a job with United Airlines in their aviation flight operations division, I gave myself a 5-year plan. I always said to the guys in my office, "Oh, I got a 5-year plan." And then the 5-year plan turned into 10, and then 15, and 20, and then I was like, "Well, already, screw the plan. I'm just here."
well, congratulations! But, you get a ding out of that.
Yeah, I get a ding out of that. 5 times 6. I should have said. I always felt like this was where I should have been from the get-go. And it's interesting because after I left United and went into TV for about 12 years and then left that and went back to teaching, I teach aviation meteorology. And one of the schools I teach at, Lewis University, which is basically right up against the National Weather Service office in the Joliet-Romeoville area, each year when I teach the introduction aviation meteorology class, which is a 2-semester class. You'll have 15 to 20 kids in each class, and routinely 5 of those 15 to 20 will be from the West Coast, parts of the California, Oregon, Washington area, even in the Vegas and Phoenix area. And they come to the Midwest to learn more about aviation weather because out there it's kind of benign. You'll get your haze, you'll get your monsoon season, but basically the weather's kind of boring unless you're up into obviously Portland and Seattle. So I it's not just me who, you know, gravitates to a place where you have exciting weather. So for the people who haven't, you know, known me, I teach not only aviation meteorology, but a huge passion for environmental science and climate change. And I teach both of those classes at Loyola University. In fact, this year, the class that I'm teaching, environmental science, is a new class. So whenever you teach a new class, there's a learning curve, and the climate change class is a new textbook. So there's a new learning curve with that. And as I always tell my climate change students, I'm here to basically teach them how to think about climate change and not basically tell them. 'Cause by nature of the title of the class, the climate is changing, yeah, but you have to kind of break it down and tell them how and why and what are the ramifications and stuff like that. So Loyola University's Institute of Environmental Sustainability is, I think, really the leader in the Midwest, obviously in the Chicago area, on promoting environmental consciousness and awareness, And with that becomes obviously, you know, sustainability, which is always a fun word to kick around because clearly you have to have, you know, sustainable efforts that have a good foundation and a good base, which is part of that is science and fact. And that's what makes it, you know, sustainable. So it's a tough class to teach, but I enjoy the challenge.
Well, let's get right to some of the stuff that you talk about. And one of the things I always enjoy, why I enjoy chatting with you, you're a good citizen of the planet in that you tell people in the United States, hey, how come you're not paying attention to what's going on over in Europe, in Asia, in Australia, yeah, in Africa, in other parts of the world? And one of the things you called to my attention is this heat wave in Northern Europe. And I'm embarrassed to say I wasn't aware of it. What's going on over there?
Well, it kind of started out early in the year, in June, and it kind of transitioned into early July. Part of it was due to the fact that the ocean temperatures across the North Atlantic were running around 3 or 4 degrees above average. Parts of Europe had a very dry area or dry region, just basically didn't get a lot of precip over the wintertime. And those are usually the key ingredients that kind of begin to allow a normal warm pattern to become a hot pattern. And this persisted for 3-4 weeks. So as we went into the latter part of June and into early July, you know, places like London ended up with temperatures that they've never seen before, up above 100 degrees. Paris, I think, topped out at 103. Barcelona was like about 105. The Madrid area was like 108. Madrid tends to be a little bit warmer than Barcelona because they're on the coast. Barcelona is. And then the heat kind of got squashed a little bit. But most meteorologists who look long term, even though they know the pattern changed, you can see it. It was just a matter of time before it went back to where it was again. And that's what's happened. So over the last about, say, 7 to 10 days, you know, the temperatures have again spiked well up into the 90s. And in some places, close to 100 degrees. And, you know, when you get into early September, your normal highs are about almost, you know, 8 degrees cooler than they were in, you know, late June, early July. So some of the anomalies are some, you know, 8 to 10 degrees above normal. And some of these temperatures across parts of Europe are, you know, all-time record highs. And because they haven't had much rain, when you get into your harvest season, which is obviously late August, September, this really begins to put a strain on the environment. So oftentimes, you know, two things happen. You know, weather patterns will always become somewhat highly variable. We know that. But if it happens during the time of the year where people depend on the weather to be normal, then the abnormality seems that much more of an impact. So if you have really, really dry weather, in late July and early August in the Midwest, but you had an extremely wet June, no one cares about it. Okay, and that's pretty much what happened this year. We had nearly 20 to 30 inches of rain in the month of June. The corn got all the water it needed. By the time we got into late July and August, things were fine. Now we want it to be dry because the farmer's going to start to harvest their crop. If we get into a 2 to 3 week period of very, very wet conditions, they're going to be like, okay, this is not good because we can't get out into the field. So, and some of the agriculturally sensitive areas of Europe are kind of going through the same thing right now from a wine standpoint. I was actually at a wine tasting last night, and I was asking the person who was pouring the glass of wine, I go, do you know about the heat and the drought in Europe? He goes, yeah, they're very concerned that this is the third year they've been into this. They may actually have to pull up some of their vineyards, some of their plants, and plant them further north because they're not able to get the type of variety that they were typically getting. So these little things that sometimes occur, I shouldn't call them little, but these news stories that may seem little to us here in the United States become much larger when they're impacting, obviously, harvesting and, you know, particularly the wine crop in parts of France and Germany. So it's been warm there. It looks like it's going to stay warm. Whether or not that has any impact on the global conditions, that I think that's still yet to be determined.
All right. We're talking to meteorologist Rick DeMaio about various weather and climate situations around the planet, and one of them that everybody is starting to talk about is the El Nino. You and I talked about that, in fact, the last time you were on the show, and I called it a super El Nino, and you smacked me down.
That's all right. You can call it a super El Nino.
No, I'm not going to. I just do that to get your goat, because I know how much you hate those kinds of terms. But the point, though, it is it's a very strong El Nino, and you look at all the maps. You know, if you have any interest in this and you see maps and you see these red blobs in the eastern Pacific right off the coast of North America, and you ask, well, what's that all about? Well, what is it all about? What's it going to, how's this going to translate to weather in the United States?
Well, that's a great question because, again, climate anomalies sometimes will have more of an impact during a certain time of the year. Typically, a strong El Nino, which this is going down as the strongest probably since 1998, usually has more of an impact as we head into the late fall and into the winter. And typically what we look for when we determine whether or not there's a strong El Nino is if the water temperatures of the eastern Pacific, generally south of Hawaii and over to the coast of South America, and I'm talking about, like, say, 15 degrees north latitude to about 5 degrees south latitude. That's a pretty big chunk of water. When that gets generally above about a degree and a half centigrade above normal, that generally is referred to as a moderate El Nino. And usually that means, you know, stormy conditions for California, Mexico, and parts of the desert Southwest. So if that does happen, that'll signify a good thing for California because they need rain. So in an odd way, one weather disaster will, you know, take care of another weather disaster, obviously the drought. Now, if you take El Nino into the context of the summertime, a lot of people don't realize it, but ocean temperatures just don't warm up and cool down in a 12-month period of time. Typically, these phenomena, because it's so large and oceans are so deep, it'll be about a 2.5 to 3 year cycle. So these water temperatures actually peaked at anywhere between 3 and 4 degrees centigrade above normal, Mike. That's almost 6 to 7 degrees above normal Fahrenheit last year. It's one of the reasons why we had 20 named storms in the eastern Pacific. Now people will go, really? I didn't hear about them. Well, you may not hear about them because they're not hitting any land masses. Most of the time it'll move into the Baja, move into central Mexico. But the biggest non-news story, weather-related, that occurred last week was the passage of Hurricane Ignacio to the north and east of Hawaii. That was a Category 4 hurricane. It missed them by about 150 to 200 miles. But Category 4 hurricanes don't happen in that part of the Pacific Ocean. And they don't go north of Hawaii by 100 miles. They usually die out 200 miles south. So if we were on the island of Hawaii right now, Mike, all everybody would be talking about are all these hurricanes that keep developing, but holy smoke, we're lucky they've been missing us. All we're going to take, all it's going to take is one large Category 2 hurricane to go dead on into the islands of Hawaii. You'll have 2 to 3 feet of rain in some of the mountains. You'll have massive flooding. And then all of a sudden, everybody will start talking about how warm the ocean water is in the Pacific. You go to Hawaii and the water temperature, yeah, it's 78, 79, 80 degrees. It's not the 84 to 85 degree water that we typically get in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
But the water temperature off the coast of the Big Island of Hawaii right now is 85 degrees. That's nearly 5 degrees warmer than normal. So again, like, this is always these things that kind of go unnoticed until all of a sudden you have a natural disaster. And that's the wrong way to kind of wake people up.
Rick DeMaio, I got my email the other day from the Farmer's Almanac. So, you know, I wasn't even sure I needed to talk to you because they have all the information you need. And
yeah, I actually, believe it or not, Mike, I actually looked at it when I was waiting in line at Blaine's Farm and Fleet.
Well, let me stop you for a second, though, because they say cold dish conditions are likely to affect the eastern portions of the Great Lakes, the lower peninsula of Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, most of the Tennessee and Mississippi Valley, as well as much of the Gulf Coast region. Last year, our bitterly cold and shivery forecast came true in many areas, including Chicago, which experienced as cold as February's on record, said one of their spokespeople. This year, many of those same areas may want to get a jump start now and stock up on lots of winter survival gear, sweaters, long johns, and plenty of firewood. But I thought El Nino usually meant a warmer winter.
This year, the feeling is that the storms in the eastern Pacific will get up to about the dateline, make a right turn, and create some very, very strong upper-level winds over parts of Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, that'll then drive some of the cold air that's already beginning to assemble up in Canada southward. So we could be in for an early dose of cold weather late October and into November. And then when El Nino kind of begins to link up with the developing subtropical jet and what we call the polar jet, that's when stormy conditions should begin to develop across the desert southwest in California. And then we'll get into a more typical El Nino pattern here in the Midwest. So we're poised here in the Midwest. We're vulnerable for, you know, an early season cool down in mid-October and also in November. And the other thing is the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes never really warmed up this year, nor did they did warm up last year. In fact, parts of Lake Superior are still only in the 40s, parts of Lake Michigan, the northern parts of it are only in the 50s. So when you get the Great Lakes averaging, you know, 3 to 4 degrees below normal, and sometimes the skin temperature is a little bit deceiving, because if you go down to the lakefront and you try to go swimming, the water temperature is down to 55, and you're like, what happened? Well, the water only got warm like the first, you know, 2 or 3 feet. All it takes is a couple of windy days, and that cooler water comes back up. So with the Great Lakes being somewhat below average, we're kind of set for a cooler pattern. So the Farmer's Almanac, I think, is onto something there. And remember, when people hear Farmer's Almanac, this isn't a bunch of farmers putting together a forecast. They have some, some qualified meteorologists that they subscribe to their services, and they put together long-range forecasts, and then they're, you know, edited down somewhat. And, you know, so there's a lot of skill involved.
Just one more word on the Farmer's Almanac before I let you go, Rick. And it says the predictions are based on a very specific mathematical and astronomical formula developed in 1818 by David Young. Oh. So this is what we're dealing with here. But
They shouldn't say that.
Okay.
Rick. I mean, we all know that Copernicus was right, but, you know, don't start off your scientific discussion with that.
He said, Copernicus was my teacher, and now let me give you my report. Rick DeMaio, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll do, Mike. I'll keep my phone on.
Okay, thanks. That's all I've got to say. Go green or go home.